That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Listen to My Life of Crime ad-free with 48 Hours Plus on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe today.
I think they were trying to come up with the perfect crime. And for a number of years, they thought they had committed the perfect crime. They thought as long as we kept our mouths shut, we didn't point the finger at each other, didn't talk about it, we had committed the perfect crime. And I think in the end, they really thought that this would never come to be, that they had gotten away with it.
For almost a decade, Colorado authorities were convinced that Daniel DeWilde killed his wife, Heather, in July of 2003 with the help of his identical twin brother, David. Investigators believe Daniel and Heather's marriage had been failing when Heather filed for divorce and was awarded temporary custody of their two young children. The judge also ruled that Daniel would have to pay child support to Heather, but Daniel had trouble making the payments.
David talked about a lot of things, but the real catalyst behind a lot of this was Daniel just was not going to pay child support. I mean, he did not want to make that payment.
And so investigators spent 8 years investigating the DeWilde twins while they remained free men. That is, until one twin turned against the other. In November 2012, Daniel DeWilde went on trial for murder, with a man who looks exactly like him testifying against him. Who will the jury believe? I'm Erin Moriarty, 48 Hours, and this is My Life of Crime. Welcome to Part 2 of Twisted Twins. Who killed Heather DeWilde? We left off at the end of our last episode with a big break in the case. After years of pressure by investigators, David DeWilde finally broke and confessed to helping his brother Daniel kill his wife and covering up the crime. He agreed to testify against Daniel in exchange for a deal, a great deal. He'd only have to serve 12 years in prison for helping to kill Heather. Daniel could go to prison for the rest of his life.
What exactly is Dan DeWilde charged with?
He's charged with murder in the first degree and conspiracy to commit murder in the first degree. And we submitted a third charge to the jury, which was accessory after the fact.
That's Daniel DeWilde's defense attorney, Tom Ward. And as you're about to hear, Daniel intends to fight the charges vigorously. As the trial gets underway, both DeWildes are in the courtroom, but only Daniel is on trial. David is the star witness. The problem for prosecutors is this. For the past 9 years, David had lied and covered for his brother. Will jurors believe him when he points the finger at him now? Here's lead investigator Russ Boatwright.
Do you believe him?
Much of what he says, yes. Everything, I mean, David's lied for 9 years.
He's a liar.
He is a liar, and he's certainly capable of lying. I think one of the things that in this situation, you know, had agreed to make a deal, you know, with the devil's twin.
A deal with the devil's twin. Wow. What a way to describe the star witness. Is David telling the truth? Was his brother Daniel the mastermind behind his wife's murder? It's something that was on the jurors' minds when they got the case at the end of the trial.
One of the first things we did was take kind of a straw poll. There were six people who voted that they weren't sure and six people who thought he was guilty.
It was really difficult. People were emotional. People were getting on one another's nerves.
There was some crying. There was some yelling that went on.
It's every prosecutor's nightmare. Robert Weiner was just as nervous.
There's a lot of pacing. There's a lot of just nervous anxiety. You start thinking, okay, what are they thinking about? What are they hung up on? Why are they taking so long?
If you remember, there certainly wasn't a lot of physical evidence for jurors to examine.
You don't have any kind of murder weapon?
Correct.
You don't have any kind of fingerprints from any suspects?
Correct.
You don't have any of Heather's blood in the house where you believed she was murdered?
Correct. There was no proverbial smoking gun to tie Daniel to Heather's murder.
Even with a case file exceeding 30,000 pages, it all really came down to the word of one twin. And as Weiner told us, that's exactly as the twins planned it. They hoped to pull off the perfect murder and leave no evidence behind. And this is the part of the story that gave me chills. Weiner says that months before they killed Heather, the two men did research.
They were watching crime shows, the CSI type shows, any crime shows that they could watch and learn.
How cold-blooded is that? Weiner told us that the brothers watched crime shows to try to come up with a foolproof crime, how they could outsmart investigators. David had told investigators that Daniel had come up with an idea to bind his wife and abandon her body to look like a sex crime gone wrong. They were careful, he said, about leaving DNA traces, wearing plastic over their clothing, and carefully handling the ropes they used to hang and tie Heather's body.
They know how some people would get caught, how we would get DNA, how we could tie fibers, for example, from a rope to a particular house. Well, they even use two pairs of rubber latex gloves so they wouldn't leave fingerprints or any DNA. So they were very cognizant of the potential in forensic law enforcement to get evidence against them.
Investigators told us that after Daniel lured his wife to the garage, they believe he hit his wife only once to minimize blood spatter. They say that the brothers had pre-dug a hole to bury Heather's body, picking a spot based on their working knowledge of the dirt and mountainsides. Investigators suspected they thought no body, no conviction.
And so they would bounce the ideas off of each other. How can we do this? Where can we bury the body? To the extent that they went up to a remote location in the mountains to try to find a place to bury the body, in fact, dug a hole and buried a pillow so that the body could be easily dumped in the hole, remove the pillow, and cover her up where no one would find her.
They worked quickly and methodically, say investigators. David said that he had taken Heather's white Nissan to an apartment complex 5 miles away while Daniel cleaned up the murder scene and put Heather's body in black trash bags. The brothers may have been almost too careful. Heather's car was so clean that it had no traces of her DNA.
There was DeWild male DNA found on the door handles. Could have been Daniel or David.
Or the DNA could have been from their son, Jacob.
But the interesting thing is, Heather DeWild's DNA was not found in her own car. So any of the control buttons, the steering wheel, her DNA is absent.
So somebody wiped it off.
Suggesting somebody wiped it down.
But there were no independent eyewitnesses to back up any of David's story. And without that supporting evidence, Daniel's defense attorney, Tom Ward, told jurors, they had to consider a different possibility, that someone else killed Heather.
And in fact, it's always been equally possible that Heather DeWild left Dan DeWild's house in her car and something else happened to her. That there was no way to disprove the possibility that Heather had left in her car and someone else had committed this murder.
Ward said that on the day Heather disappeared, when cops showed up unannounced, Daniel certainly didn't act like a man who had just killed his wife.
No sign of a struggle whatsoever. And Dan welcomed them into the house that night. They searched every area of the house, and there was nothing to indicate that anything bad had happened to Heather DeWild or anyone else in that house.
Ward also pointed out the holes in David's testimony. For example, David told the jury that after Heather was murdered, he had driven her car to the apartment complex and parked it there. That testimony seemed to be backed up by cell phone records that pinged off a nearby cell tower, confirming that he was in the area. But when police interviewed the apartment residents, they told a slightly different story.
There's one witness who saw a man in a red Chrysler LeBaron convertible, which we know was the car that David was driving that day, and that he was parked on the street that ran alongside the Greenbelt at the same time that they observed Heather's white Nissan Sentra parked in the Greenbelt with the trunk open and no one around it. I can't say from that how Heather DeWild died, but I can say that it's completely different from what David DeWild says happened. So it's a strong indication that David was parked on the side of that Greenbelt at the same time that Heather's car was parked in the Greenbelt, where, according to David, it was never there at all.
Possibly stalking her?
It's possible that he followed her there.
That David DeWild followed her?
Yes.
Could David have followed Heather and killed her himself? Well, that's certainly what the defense hoped the jurors might think. There was also another record of a cell phone call David made the night of Heather's murder, a record that Tom Ward says suggests David was lying about being at home before going to work.
I believe he may have left the house and gone to dispose of the body at that time.
What about his story that he disposed of the body in the afternoon at a place that had a lot of people milling around?
That makes no sense whatsoever. Even if David had the car trouble that he said he had and had to do something quickly, he's in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. There are dirt roads everywhere that you can drive a Chevy Suburban down and do what he had to do without anyone seeing him. And according to David, in broad daylight with about 10, 15 cars, 30 people milling around in this pull-off from the highway, people having picnics, going fishing, things like that, that he chose to do it right then and there makes no sense.
And it was David who told investigators that the brothers had watched crime shows like CSI to make sure there was no evidence. Ward said that David's story, that Daniel tried to make Heather's death look like a sex act gone wrong, actually contradicts that point.
According to David, Dan, after he had killed Heather, decided to bind the body with ropes and to bind the body with duct tape. That makes no sense whatsoever that Dan would do that. He's basically introducing items of evidence into this trash bag that serve no purpose other than to increase the chances of something being linked back to him.
And Ward even raised doubts about where Heather had been killed. Was she killed inside the garage at all?
According to David's story, while he left to dispose of Heather's car, Heather's dead body was in the garage for at least 45 minutes, maybe longer. Yet, a couple days later, when the cadaver dog went through that entire house, including the garage, the dog didn't alert on that garage.
What does that say to you?
It says to me that Heather wasn't killed in the garage. She was killed somewhere else.
And cadaver dogs did hit on Heather's car 3 times. Ward raised the possibility that Heather had actually been killed in her own car and not at the house. but at the apartment complex where her car was found.
And what would that say to you if, in fact, her body had been in her car in the Nissan?
It would say to me that the person who we know was at the apartments, David DeWild, was the person who was responsible.
So not only does David's story not hold up from what you say, but, I mean, where does most of the evidence point?
To David DeWild. David, by his own admission, is responsible for getting rid of the car. He's responsible for getting rid of the body. He's responsible for getting rid of the murder weapon. All of those things are very hard to believe that someone would do if they weren't the perpetrator.
Ward's point is that there is more evidence tying David to the murder than his brother. After all, David's the one who admits driving her car and disposing of her body.
And the one thing that you couldn't do in this case was believe that what David DeWild had to say amounted to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And without David DeWild, there is no case.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
The one thing that you couldn't do in this case was believe that what David DeWild had to say amounted to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And without David DeWild, there is no case.
There was something so bizarre and troubling about watching David testify against his brother. For one thing, the brothers look so much alike. But his testimony, at times a bit tearful, also revealed a stark difference between these two men who were supposed to be so alike. At times, David seemed to show some regret, some awareness of the terrible acts that he and his brother committed. Daniel, he showed nothing at all. Scott Story, the Jefferson County DA at the time, told me that he believed that David had been doing Daniel's bidding all his life.
Dan, Daniel, he's, like I said, the more dominant of the two. And he killed her. But who spent more time with the body? It was David, because David, being the loyal twin, took her, in his Suburban, spent a lot of time with her. And he's the one that buried her or placed her where she was and everything else.
But at some time, something changed for David. Maybe it was when he realized Daniel had lied to him about the insurance money he would collect at Heather's death. Maybe it was when he realized his actions put his own wife, Roseanne, at risk. Or maybe he was just trying to save his own skin. Whatever the reason, he turned on his twin brother, and now his job was to convince 12 jurors he was telling the truth.
What did you all think? I'll start with you, Darren, this idea of a brother testifying against another brother.
I spoke with 5 jurors after the trial. This is juror Darren Kennedy.
Well, twins can be a strong bond, according to a lot of the testimony. Those people said they never left each other's side. And I truly believe that, Daniel was the dominant one.
They, too, believe that Daniel was calling the shots. Some said that Daniel's interest in bondage and making the murder look like a sex crime gone wrong was evidence of someone who needed to be in control. This is juror Chris Elon and another juror, Scott Hazelwood.
It's pretty clear from the sex tape and the testimony of how much he was into S&M things and just the rest of the testimony about his personality, that he's a person that enjoys being in control and dominating others.
They can't stand to not be in control, I think.
Yeah, not too.
They told me that Daniel's dominant personality helped to bolster the prosecution's case. It helped explain why David waited so long to confess. This is Scott Hazelwood again and juror Vicki Goodwin.
It took me till later in the trial when they really started talking about how Daniel was the dominant brother and how David was kind of, you know, the more submissive brother. That put a lot more pieces together for me. So to me, once I was able to put those pieces together with it, it made more sense as to why David was more pressured into it. And then after so long in jail, just said, you know, I got nothing to lose by confessing at this point. I think he'd been removed from David or Daniel's, you know, pressure enough at that point.
Being separated, it helped him to come forward with his story.
The jurors I spoke to believe that David couldn't stand up for himself until he was in jail and separated from his brother. And this is as good a place as any to tell you what the jurors didn't hear at the trial. It's yet another shocking detail of this case. According to investigators, once David got away from his brother, he confessed to all the chilling details, including this one. The original plan was to kill two people. According to David, his brother had offered to kill David's ex-wife, Vicky, as a way to get David on board, a two-for-one kind of deal. Lead investigator Russ Boatwright.
He was actually going to kill her in the residence and then start a fire a short distance from the home to make it appear as though there had been a fire, and then again, assuming the evidence gets destroyed in that process.
I mean, Russ, as you sit here today, do you think it's possible that Dan was thinking that after he killed Heather and got away with it, that he would kill his brother's ex-wife?
I do think he would have. I think that's entirely possible.
What does that say about Daniel DeWild?
It's just his level of arrogance and his ego. It just amazes me. Like I said, I was shocked when David told me that. I thought, you have got to be kidding me. That is like the dumbest thing I have ever heard.
But as I mentioned earlier, the jurors didn't hear all these details. And when they finally had to decide Daniel's fate, they were torn. After days of deliberations, the jurors could only agree on two lesser charges. There were two holdouts with doubts. While the jurors all believed that Daniel DeWild planned to kill his wife, Heather, and that he helped cover up the crime, they couldn't agree on which brother actually did the killing. Juror Vicki Goodwin.
That ultimately was the biggest problem with the two jurors who really weren't able to go to guilty, was that they felt that every piece of evidence was kind of tailor-made to fit David's story, as opposed to the other way around, where David's story, you know, that information that was withheld versus the information that they provided, that they kind of fit together. That was just a difference in how they perceived it.
Daniel DeWild was convicted of conspiracy and accessory to murder, but the jury was hung on the issue of first-degree murder. The verdict meant Daniel would go to prison, but for how long? It was a development that was tough for District Attorney Scott Story. If you recall from part one, Story told me that he had been driven to get justice for Heather after meeting with her family all those years ago. And now, even with this verdict, he wasn't going to give up.
What was your reaction?
We're doing it again.
Oh, right away?
Oh, absolutely.
You heard it. The prosecution decided to retry Daniel DeWild once again for first-degree murder. Another trial. But amazingly, that wasn't necessary. His defense attorney told us that Daniel was fearful that another jury could send him to prison for life, and he wasn't willing to take that chance. 1 month later, Daniel took a deal and pleaded guilty to second-degree murder.
All right, let's call People versus Daniel DeWild.
On February 28, 2013, almost 10 years after Heather's murder, Daniel DeWild was in court for sentencing.
I pled guilty to knowingly causing the death of another person.
Conspiracy. As part of that deal, Daniel DeWild also gave up the right to appeal. At the sentencing, Heather's father, Dave Springer, told the world what he thought of his former son-in-law.
I'd just like to say that Daniel destroyed the life of his children. He destroyed the life of his own family members, all for unnecessary greed and ego.
I was in the courtroom that day and remembered what David had told a court weeks earlier. David seemed to have deep regret.
I feel horrible about the pain. All I can say is I'm sorry. I'm just sorry for all the pain it caused.
Now, finally a chance to hear from the mastermind of the murder. Did Daniel have the same regrets? We'll never know. Daniel told the judge that he had nothing to say.
Is it true that you do not want to exercise that right?
That's true.
It would have taken nothing for Daniel at sentencing just to turn to the Springer family and just say, I'm sorry. It's just not in Daniel's character to do that.
Lead investigator Russ Boatwright believed Daniel felt nothing, that David had told him earlier that Daniel actually enjoyed inflicting pain on Heather's family.
He thought Daniel went to bed every night knowing that Dave Springer thought he killed his daughter and couldn't prove it. And he said, Daniel, I know, got satisfaction from that.
Judge Christopher Munch sentenced Daniel to 74 years in prison.
I'm glad he got the length of sentence he did, and he deserved more, but that's it.
As part of his plea deal, David was sentenced to 12 years in prison. He was released on parole in 2020. Daniel DeWild remains in prison. I've thought about this case a lot. I mean, you could say that Daniel DeWild did, in the end, devise a perfect crime. But there was a weak link, and he was that weak link. Daniel DeWild, like so many killers, overestimated his powers. Daniel believed that because he and David were identical twins, they would think alike and never betray each other. David may have been uncomfortable. He even tried to talk Daniel out of his murderous plan. And yet, for almost 10 years, David's actions seemed to confirm that the twins were on the same page. Twins bound together by a horrible secret. Until David finally gave in to his conscience. I'm Erin Moriarty, 48 Hours, and that is my life of crime. This podcast series is developed by 48 Hours in partnership with CBS News Radio and Paramount. Judy Tigard is 48 Hours executive producer. Megan Marcus is vice president for podcast editorial at Paramount. Production and editing for this season by Caroline Casey, Annie Cronenberg, Danny Levy, Megan Marcus, Kiara Norbitz, and Alan Pang. This episode was also produced by Lisa Fried and Mike McHugh of 48 Hours. And finally, a thank you to all of you, our listeners. We owe it all to you, the millions of 48 Hours fans. Don't forget to join me online. I'm at EF Moriarty on X, and we're at 48 Hours on X, Facebook, and Instagram. See you soon.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money, and maybe more importantly, on your life. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.
If you're listening to this podcast, then chances are good you are a fan of The Strange, Dark, and Mysterious. And if that's the case, then I've got some good news. We just launched a brand new Strange, Dark, and Mysterious podcast called Mr. Ballin's Medical Mysteries. And as the name suggests, it's a show about medical mysteries, a genre that many fans have been asking us to dive into for years, and we finally decided to take the plunge, and the show is awesome. In this free weekly show, we explore bizarre, unheard-of diseases, strange medical mishaps, unexplainable deaths, and everything in between. Each story is totally true and totally terrifying. Go follow Mr. Ballin's Medical Mysteries wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're a Prime member, you can listen early and ad-free on Amazon Music.